Hello, 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 you gorgeous, sexy, talented people. Welcome back, of course, to Sound Perspective. It is I, your host, Alfie Faber. And if you haven't listened before, this is the podcast where I interview the people in film who combine sight and sound, or just kind of like whoever piques my interest in filmmaking. Could be anyone. Could be directors, sound designers, composers. Who knows? Who knows what'll be next? And this week was a really phenomenal one. An interview with an incredible Australian director called Thomas M. Wright. I won't ramble too much about him because we chat a lot about everything, but he's done two features, which are both incredible. His first feature was called Acute Misfortune. It's based on the true story of a young Sydney journalist who develops an unhealthy relationship with a violent and eccentric artist who has commissioned him to write his biography. His second feature was a Netflix original called The Stranger. It premiered last year, 2022, at Cannes. In Uncertain Regard. I have no idea if I'm pronouncing that right. I'm probably butchering it. I'm so sorry to any French people listening. I have no idea how to pronounce French stuff. The Stranger stars Joel Edgerton and Sean Harris and is also based on a true story, this one being the Australian police operation in which an undercover policeman befriends and gains the trust of a suspected child murderer in order to get him to confess. If you're someone who's turned off by the whole true crime thing, which is totally fair enough, I'd recommend you give The Stranger a chance. It's deeply empathetic. It's very respectful of the victims. There is absolutely no violence in it. It never depicts the child or the event that happens. It focuses in a very empathetic way on the impact that the police operation had on the police themselves. Thomas's directing style is absolutely fucking sublime, and if you haven't seen either of those films, I'd check them out, because we got so carried away in our excited discussion that we were just jumping all over the place. In Australia, Acute Misfortune is on Stan, and in the US, it is apparently on Amazon Prime, according to Google. That's what Google tells me. I don't know. I'm not in the US. And of course, in any country, The Stranger is on Netflix. Thomas lives in Melbourne, and I'm in Sydney. And when I was there last week, he was kind enough to invite me to his home for the interview. We recorded in his study, so not the best audio quality, but it was a super interesting chat. So you won't even notice. Once again, follow me on the socials. I'm Alfie Faber on Insta and Letterboxd. You can follow Sound Perspective on Facebook. And now here we are listening to Thomas Wright, who started the conversation by telling me about a dream he had had the night before.
Yeah, great. Do you ever have a dream where the dream actually stays with you through the day?
Yeah.
So yeah. I had a dream. I woke up this morning really early because my son heard our cat howling. It's your cat, but he let it out early this morning. And he heard the cat howling. So he ran out into the lane and the cat was fighting with another cat. He was really like distressed. It's like 10 to 6.
Oh, no.
And it came back in and I went back to bed and I had a dream that I was driving in this van through this strange sort of country and I came to this hilly little sort of vale, like a small hilly valley at night, and this shape was running around behind, around and under my legs, and I felt like I was being hunted by this little dark like silver fox.
Oh, no.
And this feeling has just stayed with me.
Yeah.
All day. Anyway.
That's crazy. What's even weirder is when, like, you can't exactly remember what a dream was about, but you remember the feeling, and it's the feeling that stays with you.
Yep.
That's terrifying. Yeah. 'Cause you don't know why. You're so scared.
It's not a bad way to start talking about The Stranger, actually. It's actually, well, the whole film is built around dreams, and the whole film is like a dream.
Yeah.
Because it's a false reality that's being created. I think that was something that definitely drew me to it, because it also felt like within the film, you also have the process of making a film. You have the process of writing these scenarios, casting the parts, and then having to, you know, find a way to document it, filming it and recording it and cataloging it and building a narrative.
Yeah.
But it is unreal. And it isn't as sustaining as a real life. It's a thin kind of dream that's actually being sustained. And that's what the tension of the film is, obviously.
Yeah.
Because you feel like that could collapse at any time.
Well, I'd also love to talk about like Acute Misfortune and like how you got into movies, but considering that we're on The Stranger, something that I wanted to chat about is what a prominent role contrast plays in the film, and how it starts out. The film seems to start out like very black and white, especially in the values and themes it's exploring, and as Mark, as his character kind of loses touch with who he is somewhat, it starts to move more towards a grey area.
But it's always doubled, isn't it, in the film too? It's always kind of mirrored, because you also have Henry who's projecting a kind of black and white version of himself. Mm. Everyone is reduced to these very basic binary things, which is also often the way that we interact with strangers.
Yeah.
Acute Misfortune is very concerned with that idea as well, which is like, how can you know a person? How can you look at someone, look them up and down? Yeah, you can make a whole series of conclusions about that person, but they're going to be necessarily false or simplistic.
Mm.
And in that film, that was kind of a judgment about journalism and what a lot of journalism is.
Yeah.
The question at the center of that in Acute Misfortune was, if you can meet someone, look them up and down, make a whole series of assessments about them and put them down in print, does that make you insightful?
Mm.
Or does it just make you a prick? You know, like, does that just make you a person whose values are skewed?
Yeah.
And skewed by their profession. But yeah, in The Stranger, it is these very, very, it is very black and white.
Mm.
Even, you know, you talk about the values. I assume you're talking more generally about the kind of filmic values when you say that as well, light and dark and loud and quiet and interior and exterior.
Yeah.
And yeah, it was very consciously built around those kind of opposite charges. And contrast is something that I think comes in part from my background as well, because often coming from theatre, contrast is one of the great tools that you have.
Mm.
Theatre is built around those kind of contrasts. A scene is going along and then all of a sudden the lights go out.
Mm.
And you know that there hasn't been a fault. It's inbuilt in the way that we understand theatre, that we know that's the end of end of the scene, you know.
Yeah.
But then you may introduce a loud sound or an incredibly quiet sound, and you're trying to make your audience work and lean into the thing that you're making and become an active participant.
Mm.
And the beginning of The Stranger is very much doing that as well, even with things like breath and that meditative kind of exercise that's there at the beginning is to make you physically involved, whether you know it or not, from the first 20 seconds of the film.
Yeah.
You know,
I think breath is really interesting to have as a motif in a film, because it's something that's so essential for life. And I mean, the film kind of deals with death and...
Yep.
Yeah.
And the most fascinating thing about breath, and I think it's these kind of things that you're trying to remind yourself of when you're setting out to tell a story, is the thing that we forget is that we're... I mean, it sounds so obvious when you say it aloud, but we're breathing all the time.
Yeah.
And we're not conscious of it.
Yeah.
You know, it's an automatic reflex that our body's just undertaking on our behalf. But if it stops, we die. I don't know. Maybe there was something about making people conscious of breath. But it's also a really central aspect of that story, you know.
Because it's like it's about his anxiety and his fear.
It's also about a child who has stopped from breathing.
Yeah, yeah, of course.
So and that act of violence always remains, you know, hidden and veiled in the film. It's never addressed directly. But, you know, you talked about with dreams and the way that feeling can carry through everything. That was absolutely the design of The Stranger. It's like it's something that we can't quite remember. It's something that we can't quite touch. There's a black hole at the center of this work, and it's the violence that that character was actually guilty of, but that nobody will ever know about except for two people. And one of them's not there to be able to tell their story, to tell what happened to them. And, you know, all the time working with this material, you're aware that you're dealing with a real story, with real things that happen. And I felt a huge responsibility, not only to that case, you know, on which it was based, but for everybody who comes into contact with that degree of violence and in really deeply thinking about the human capacity for violence, this thing that's ever present and doesn't seem to resolve. And I find it the greatest tragedy, you know, the fact that human beings seem to be incapable of evolving beyond that, that kind of violence.
Yeah. Mm. Well, if it's beginning from the start a bit more, I'd love to talk about your background and what led you to this.
Yeah.
So you began as an actor, but what led you to wanting to direct?
Well, really, like I started acting as a teenager. I have, my family has got nothing to do with that. My father was a senior public servant and consultant. My mother was a general practitioner, doctor. There's nobody in my family that comes from a kind of arts background. And I was just, I was so drawn to it. I couldn't conceive of doing anything else. But really the only tool that I had as a teenager was my body and my mind and my voice. And I didn't know anything really about story, you know. I didn't know how these things were made. I knew nothing about cinema. I just loved it. And I was one of those kids who every weekend would be down at Video Easy or Blockbuster or what have you, just coming out with armfuls of films and coming home and watching 10 movies, you know. So it was a way to reach out and sort of touch that. It was always like this other world, like this other reality that was out there outside of my own. And so, you know, I was very fortunate in that by the time I was, you know, in my sort of senior years of high school, I was working fairly full time as an actor and being able to travel and work and earn money and do that. But it was very apparent that it was just like, I mean, the idea of directing film, like moving to directing film, and before that directing theatre and writing theatre felt like something I had really like no right to. I really had a very strong sense that that was like that. That was something that other people did. That was something that I wasn't allowed to try to do. I wouldn't have even known where to fucking begin, you know. But over the years of working, and I formed a theatre company in my early 20s.
Oh, right.
So I formed a company called Black Lung, which became one of the most successful independent companies in Australia.
Right.
When I was very young.
Right.
And we just made a whole lot of self-devised and kind of experimental work, really, was what we did. So we were creating work for a lot of the major companies, that sort of thing. But I wasn't looking at theatre as a stepping stone into film. It was a medium that I was exploring in every way that I could, not really thinking about anything else. I was acting in other films. By that point, I acted in the film Van Diemen's Land and Robert Connolly's film Balibo. And then out of that work that I was doing in theatre, I ended up playing a lead role for Sydney Theatre Company, which Cate Blanchett and Andrew Upton had programmed, a production that Simon Stone was directing of Baal. It's Brecht's first play. And Jane Campion saw that production of Baal and then cast me in Top of the Lake. And then I really started working in film really full-time. And since that day, actually, since that production, I haven't worked in theatre again.
Oh,
so
right.
That was 12 years ago.
Yeah.
And I do love that art form, and I'd love to return to it at some point. But I started acting in film full time and mostly working overseas. So mostly working in the States and Europe and England. And I started thinking that I thought that I could do it. You know, I tried to teach myself to write. I was a very bad writer compared to most of my contemporaries, and a lot of the people that I was working with in that company were more gifted writers than I was. I really struggled with it, and I had a very strange take on writing. But I decided at one point that I would lock myself away in my house and I'd just stay up all night, every night. So I'd wake up at like 6 p.m. And I'd write through until 6 a.m. And I did that for about 4 months.
You found you worked better at night?
No. I went into a kind of mad hermetic seal.
Yeah.
And I wrote a treatment for a feature film, though. I wrote an entire outline for a feature film. But I was so confused about what writing was that, I mean, I can't even tell you. It seems so strange to say now. But, like, I wouldn't use lowercase i's because I didn't like the shape of them. So I think it's funny at moments like that talking about that sort of thing, I realize that my way of coming at things is actually quite eccentric. But I wouldn't have been aware of it at the time. I was just desperately trying to make it work and responding to these feelings that I had. Anyway, I wrote this treatment for a film. I threw it away. I wrote another feature script, and I took it to Robert Connolly, and I said, what do you think of this? Could you make it? And he said, you know, this may well be completely genius work.
Oh, great.
But I can't produce this because it's so far outside of anything else, and it has no basis. And it was a story about two brothers, basically, two brothers, the sons of the same father, and the father passes away out on this remote island, and he was a famous children's book illustrator and went into making films for children and that sort of thing. He passed away, and one of the sons are reunited out on this island where the father dies, and one of them becomes convinced that the father may have died by some unnatural cause, you know?
Yeah.
And they go on this, they kind of tumble headlong into this couple of days of intense alcoholism and then set fire to this small town. and so Rob had said this to me, that he was like, I'm not sure this how you would, you know, do this, let alone realistically on the kind of money that it would take. And you know, I had no idea about any of that sort of thing. And then I read an excerpt from Eric Jensen's book Acute Misfortune in one of the weekend papers.
Yeah.
And I wrote to Eric and said that I thought this could be adapted into a film. And you can even see with Acute Misfortune and that earlier idea, there are some sort of alignments there.
Yeah.
And I took it to Rob and spoke to Rob about it. He said, this is a film. This is really something that we could do. And then you know, I ended up writing the film with Eric. But even still at that point, it wasn't clear that I was going to direct that film.
I
thought that I would write it. I thought that I would make my film about the brothers somehow because I was obsessed. But I thought with Acute Misfortune that we would talk to another filmmaker, that Eric and I would write it together. We'd sort of bring our very different skills together. You know, Eric is a really very high-level journalist who founded the Saturday Paper when he was 23.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I come from that sort of more experimental and narrative and devised theatre background, but also from, you know, I'd been telling a lot of long form stories on multiple series and that sort of thing overseas. And anyway, so we hit a point where Rob turned to me in the development of that film. I think we'd probably already been working on it for a year and a half. And he said, I think you should make this, you know, that makes sense. Great. And I was very anxious, and I reached out to Eric and said, look, you know, Rob has sort of said this, and I'm actually starting to think that that might make sense. And what do you think? And he said, well, I always assumed that you were gonna do this. That's because you're so deep in it, and you know as much, you know, I don't know everything Eric knows. Obviously, he lived through the experiences that are in that film. But No one else was going to come that close to that material. So, but both films that I've made have come from this incredible process of research, you know, like a couple of years in the case of Acute Misfortune and a year or more on The Stranger of full-time research into a field that I don't necessarily know a lot about. So it became almost more like an investigative process. And then that led into all the choices of the actual making of the films and the directing of the films.
Yeah, it's almost like it's like sci-fi. It's world building.
It's world building.
Even though it's a real, even though it's a real world.
And it's learning to think differently too. You're not wanting to just come to your own ideas about how these things should be done. And the filmmakers that I'm most inspired by, I think, are filmmakers who are completely changed by the material that they are dealing with. And they begin to use the resources at their disposal completely differently and are kind of being led by the material. And I think there's no greater feeling also as an artist than when you feel like you haven't done these things. That they have kind of happened. And you've just been like a piece of copper wiring that's connecting the material to the film that's made. It's just kind of, you're trying to let it run through you.
I think both Acute Misfortune and The Stranger, although they're set in the real world and they're based on real stories, they're about ordinary people put in extraordinary situations, which is Eric being thrust into this weird toxic relationship where it's almost cult-like, his relationship. It seems, well, I mean, I haven't read the book and...
It's a great book.
I should read it,
Sure I'll have an extra copy here.
But he, it seems from the film like he developed this relationship with Adam where... It was like kind of codependent or like just a really weird toxic relationship.
It's so many things, isn't it? Because it's like a father-son. It's like a mentor and a pupil, a teacher and a student, like a older brother and a younger brother, like lovers, like dear friends. But every aspect of those relationships is, being... betrayed and being eroded in it, and it's also a relationship of codependency.
Yeah,
and it's a relationship that's based on theft. And I always sort of said that I felt like Acute Misfortune was a film about theft, and The Stranger was a film about lies. But they're both relationships based on those kind of premises.
Yeah,
I don't really know why. But that idea that Eric is completely on Adam for the book and Adam is dependent on Eric for validation or to have some sort of foil.
So what was it that drew you to that article?
When I read the article, it actually made me extremely angry. I almost threw the paper across the room. So my first reaction was one of anger. Because of everything that Adam stood for and his attitudes, and I think we were probably a little ahead of the curve there, even in terms of dealing with that kind of subject matter and what does being an artist entitle you to? You know, I mean, it's so overt with Adam in that particular mentality of his, the idea that an artist could get by having major retrospectives at the State Gallery with the swastikas tattooed on his arms. It's almost unthinkable. Now it is unthinkable now. But that was something that was, it would have been questioned, but it would have been debated. Adam was necessarily a provocative individual, but I also believe that Adam was a racist individual. I do think Adam had some and grew into perhaps some really very dark and very negative attitudes toward himself and toward life and toward others. I don't know. I think partly they're, a product of the culture that we're a part of. And I really felt like Acute Misfortune was very much a film about culture, very much a film about how we learn to be and what the precedents are of our culture. So if you, either have certain aspects of your personality type that fit naturally within a kind of career or field, or that there is space that's accommodated for you and certain facets of your personality in a field. And I was interested in those negatives. You know, the film obviously begins with Eric sitting on a train station platform, looking at people and describing them and describing their backstory for the amusement of his friends. Which comes back to that question I was asking before, like, well, what does that make you if you're capable of that as a 19, 20 year old, or even as a fully grown adult at any stage? Are you entitled to judge people that way? But that's a characteristic that's really valued in the press.
Yeah.
It's considered insight, you know, it's like a biting kind of cutting insight. I don't think Eric holds to that, and I think the values of the Saturday paper show that that's not where he actually works from or where his principles are. But, you know, at the same time, he's an extraordinarily ambitious young person. And in everything, when you're making a film, there's always an element of auto-portraiture about that sort of stuff. I think I was also looking at periods of time where that's been a facet of my personality too. The idea that that privileged you with some sort of insight. I was always fascinated by, you know, something like, I remember watching D.A. Pennebaker's film, Don't Look Back, about Bob Dylan, where he sits across a journalist from Time magazine, and he says, I know more about you just by looking than you'll ever know about me.
Yeah.
And he believes it. I'm not sure whether that's not kind of psychopathic. You know, someone said to me once in a park about Bob Dylan, I love him, but I'd never vote for him. but again, that's the privilege of a position given to an artist.
Yeah. There's this amazing quote that I wrote down from the film of, he paints violent men, but never says what he thinks of them. And, something...
That's a beautiful kind of that's just classic Eric
for
me. That's a quote from some of Eric's writing about Adam, and I love the amorphousness of a comment like that. It's simultaneously like pushing deeply into something that you know and can feel, but it's also there's also an ambiguity in that statement itself.
Yeah,
he paints violent men, but never says what he thinks of them. Mm.
But I think it was especially telling when used in this film. And also in this Stranger somewhat, but because you're depicting this very objectively awful person, and a lot of people when making a film about a person like that would choose to make it very clear and in your face that you're meant to hate this person, and it's like didactic, and they would push it down your throat, and you leave it... You leave it a bit vague.
I think the film has a very strong position, but I'm not interested in writing speeches.
Yeah,
if I wanted
exactly.
to be a speechwriter, I'd be a speechwriter. I think making films requires a greater depth of nuance. Not that you can't have characters who are like finally entirely evil. I think that's the truth of Henry in The Stranger, you know. But if I was just to deliver that message, I mean, I think it undermines and kind of condescends to your audience. I like films that make me work. I like to have to find my own position. And I think life's more often, at least, more complex than that.
And I
think Adam's cultural standing speaks to the necessity for that too. It's like his paintings were hanging in the Prime Minister's house. They were hanging in Malcolm and Lucy Turnbull's house.
Right.
So you can damn him and you can damn them and what I think it actually means for corporate culture to encourage this guy or for people, for him to have a fucking vodka sponsor, for God's sake,
really?
Which he had, or for the Cullen Hotel to base itself on him. You know, we're the Art Series Hotel, which when they sold it years later, they said the Cullen Hotel was ultimately always a real estate play. You're like, this is a mutually parasitic economic and cultural situation.
Yeah.
I think, but that's not to say that Adam didn't have periods of time where he created fucking great work.
Yeah.
Adam's paintings at a certain period of time were extraordinary. Mm. And his little sculptural works that I know Eric responded to so much, they're beautiful and they're tragic and they're loaded with feeling.
Mm.
And he hit a vein where he was able to get through to something very deep within our culture. It's a narrow prism through which to look at it. But it was also, you know, a really fine series of statements there. And unfortunately, you know, I don't think it's oversimplifying it to say that addiction actually, it was probably one of the main things that undid him, you know.
Mm.
I said something very emphatic and then I sort of started making qualifiers. But I think addiction did undo him.
Yeah.
And undid his work. And yeah. I think he became a parody of the artist that he was and the person that he was.
Tying into how you kind of don't shove things down people's throats, I've never seen a filmmaker with as much restraint as yourself, and you, like no other director I've seen, you know how to shoot the things that aren't happening. And like, for example, in one of the first scenes of Acute Misfortune, where he's in the house with the woman reporting on the story of the dead son or something, and it starts by seeing the camera flashes in the corner of the room instead of just jumping onto the action. But do you have to kind of force that restraint on yourself, or does it come naturally to you?
Well, it does, but it also comes from looking at the material that you get and then finding the most eloquent way to say the thing that you mean to say. Yeah. Not everything that happens, especially in Acute Misfortune, was pre-planned and intended to land in the exact form that it happened. It certainly is that way for large sections of the film, and then there's large sections of the film where I'm looking for other associations and I'm looking for other feelings. And I remember a lot with Acute Misfortune saying, I wanted a feeling that I could almost reach out and touch, but never quite touch. And I think, you know, it's all for me about form and content. And the fact is that at that, as much as Eric might seem very callous and cold and squared away in that scene, I think you're also witnessing this scene through the eyes of someone that's actually finding this too much to manage and who's actually being traumatized by the things that they're being put in contact with over and over again. Yeah. For a 19-year-old cadet reporter to be sent out to door knock people who've just lost people to, you know, an incident with a firearm or a car accident. A 19-year-old isn't really actually equipped to deal with that sort of stuff. So in some ways that's a formal question about how you make your way into that scene. The fact that you're giving the audience almost the lens of a kind of detective, that they're piecing together fragments from early on in that film. And that's something that's true for both films too, is an attempt to make you active in working out what's going on, not just putting it on a plate.
Yeah.
But you're also trying to get inside the head and inside the unique feelings of the characters whose story you're telling, and let that change the material. But it's a combination of things. I think it's a little bit of instinct. Mm. It's a little bit of genuine perspective, sort of how you see the world, and for me, very much an attempt to make sense of reality through stories.
Yeah,
because I think they make life easier. And that's something I'm wrestling with myself as I make films.
Yeah.
That's that.
I also love movies that make you lean in and that you have to kind of work to understand, as yours very much are. And I think that watching a film at home makes it so much harder to engage with that, because it's a lot easier to get distracted at home than it is in a cinema. And with The Stranger being a Netflix original, how does it make you feel to know that a lot of people will be watching it at home?
Well, it's a trade-off, isn't it?
Yeah.
Unfortunately, we can't just like get on our little time travel bicycle and like backpedal and go back to the point where it would have played in theaters. And, you know, Margaret and David would have talked about it on the weekend. It would have become more of a cultural event, because we had the conditions then to celebrate and acknowledge what's happening specifically in a place at any given time, where now everything is just scattered. It is desperately scattered. And how we receive culture and how we engage with it is becoming more kind of homogenized and strange and more tailored to the individual, I suppose. The fact is that the film got watched, what was it? It was like 40 million hours in the first 10 days.
Why hours though? Why do they measure it in hours?
Well, like, that's the metrics they're able to talk about.
I know.
You know, and...
But I mean, sorry, great numbers though, by the way.
Well, yeah, it's, I mean, it became a... Great numbers. You know, this is not a large film. It might feel like a large film, but this film was made on a very concentrated budget.
Mm.
And the only way that it's able to feel, I think, as well realized as it is because we had a year of pre-production.
All right.
And we were desperately planning to try to create something on the highest international level, but done at an Australian budget level, just like anything else, even less than a lot of things.
Mm.
But it became the second most watched film in the world on Netflix. So, you know, that reach is really unprecedented, to know that, like, I hear from people in South America and islands in the Pacific, and, you know, it went nuts all over Europe, a lot of Spanish-speaking countries, and in Germany, all over the world. The film was seen, and I think it brought, you know, I think The Stranger in particular is very much in conversation with a kind of lineage of Australian film that's in that kind of genre.
Yeah.
It's kind of outsider crime-focused.
Australian gothic.
Yeah, I suppose you could call it that, yeah. Yeah.
Not to lump,
yeah, like an Australian crime film, because actually they're all so different. Like,
yeah,
when you look
exactly.
at when you look at The Boys, or you look at Animal Kingdom, or Snowtown, or Chopper, or, you know, what have you, or Hale, Emil Corton Wilson's film. These are extraordinarily different films.
Mm.
They are really profoundly different, but they are defined by a kind of, there's a darkness in there.
Mm.
There's a darkness, there's a sense of enormous unease. And it's a very particular architecture, this kind of Australian character, which is what Adam in Acute Misfortune was so self-consciously trying to create for himself. Mm. So to have it have that reach, I think, is fantastic. But, yeah, I mean, like, I think films that are really strong can transcend that.
Yeah.
I watched Godfather Part 1 and 2 over the last couple of days at home, and I couldn't move, you know. It's so extraordinary, and just as much watching it off a DVD as I saw it in a cinema in Pittsburgh a couple of years ago. You know, you're just so locked in, with those films. But yeah, I mean, of course you'd love to see it in a cinema. And I also think that kind of meditative process and the empathic process of giving over completely to a film and giving over completely to form and its content, or content and its form, you know, changes you. I always remember that feeling. You remember that feeling of coming out of a film, and when you were younger in particular, I remember coming out and feeling like the world looked different. Everything had been changed. And I do think cinema can be this extraordinary machine of empathy that can take you into other perspectives and into other realities. But, yeah. That's the circumstances of the way that we watch and view films now. So I'm thankful to them for that we were able to reach that audience, and I think it was an extraordinary success for Netflix Australia that a film like ours did what it did.
Yeah.
But also, you know, we premiered at Cannes and then we played at London BFI and then we played at Sitges, and then we had this, you know, season in Melbourne, and then the film was released on cinema screens around Australia as well. So it's kind of, there's not much more that you could really ask for.
Yeah.
now. But yeah, of course, I mean, I wish we all went to the cinema a lot more, you know.
Yeah, I mean, it's you kind of think like you wish people supported cinema more, but also you can't ask people to have hobbies that they're not interested in.
Well, it's not so much that. It's the fact that people feel like they somehow don't have time or something like that. And I do think there's a lot more anxiety in the society and the idea of taking a couple of hours away to go and sit down and watch a film almost feels indulgent or something like that, which is a really deep imbalance. Mm. I think there's something really wrong. Mm. And maybe I'm just projecting. It may well be just projecting, but I do think there's an element of that. It's like I can just do it at home. I can do it while I'm doing this, But I'll check my phone while I'm doing that. I'll check the news and you know all that sort of stuff. It's so scattering.
Yeah.
But I spoke before. I do think it's an interesting thing. There's some interesting alignments with the stranger coming into people's homes because it's about the fear, the type of fear that makes its way into your home.
Mm.
So I think in that way it was actually a really interesting experiment for me to see whether it would be even more effective or perhaps even more frightening, those aspects of it.
Mm.
But also because of the fact that it's a film that's built entirely on empathy.
Mm.
Like the film, empathy is the central pillar of that construction. It's how you can never see that child. How we can show no violence, but you still understand what has happened because I wanted you to personalize it in the same way that main character does and has to, and the way that affects everybody that comes close to that sort of material. It's really what holds our society together, right?
Mm.
You know, we are these nations of strangers, you know. And we're held together by a mutual dependence and a degree of empathy.
Mm.
So
I saw The Stranger at a screening where you did a Q&A and you told a story about how that incredible rhythmic fluttering sound relates to when you were location scouting.
Yeah.
And you, what, tell me, well, that, we, that was
we,
interesting.
Well, we were scouting the film. And as I said, it was, you know, like we only had 7 weeks to shoot this film, 7.5 weeks.
Right.
And that's 250 part scenes. So the maths is not good.
Yeah.
We were shooting 8 scenes a day often. And I'm not talking about like little cutaways. It's like substantial pieces. And there are sequences in that movie, long, like 6-7 minute sequences that were shot in less than half a day.
Yeah.
And that just required, you know, really intense preparation and focus. Mm. And that's the thing. But one of the things that happened while we were scouting the film, where we were on a recce with a number of heads of department and that sort of thing, we went out to this underpass location, the site where the child was taken. And we got out there at night, which was the time it was intended to be shot, and the producers went into a panic, as well as, I think, to be fair to him, it was a relative level of panic, but the director of photography, Sam, as well, thinking, how the fuck are we going to light this? It's a black hole.
Yeah.
We were out in the middle of the country. There was nothing around. There was no way to see where we were. And everyone was really worried and saying, we're going to have to find another location. And I said, everybody just go quiet for a moment. And everybody went quiet. And you could hear this. Of the cars passing overhead.
Mm.
And I said, well, for a start, that's how we're going to know where we are. We're going to use that sound. And I'll even begin the film with that sound. This is the center of everything. And that sound aligned with breath and it aligned with place and aligned with some sort of mystery that was there at the center of the film about its setting. Mm. But the way that sound also, that came into being, was partly from that, but also that I felt I needed I wanted all the sounds in the film to be tactile and to be practical, to not be, you know, digital or synthesizer based or whatever, I don't know what you'd call them, synthetic sounds. I wanted them to be really organic and physical. And I heard the work of this Melbourne percussionist, Matthias Schakarnet, who'd built this machine that was a big revolving disc that he actually applies pressure to this thing with different elements. So it's a physical act that he's doing, a physical grinding of this machine. And so that that became this sort of sound, that sort of strange fluttering that's at the center of the film.
Yeah. Your composer, Oliver Coates, also just went just on...
He's just on Steve McQueen's new
film. Oh, really? Mm-hmm. Oh, wow. Mm. So he's just gone on to do After Sun, which, although, I mean, they're kind of polar opposites, but I think they're both... there's something quite similar in both of them. There's a bit of love in both of them.
Wow, okay.
Like, I mean, they're opposite ends of the spectrum, but, you know, the people in The Stranger are doing it out of love.
Yeah,
and,
that's right.
After Sun, there's a lot of pain, but and there's also
And they're both enormous tragedies, actually, I think, and they're films about loss and films about a kind of unspeakable, with an unspeakable kind of loss at the center. Yeah, completely different films.
But I think they, the soundtracks, if I remember, I mean, I only saw After Sun once, but they're both kind of very string heavy, am I right?
Yeah, well, Ollie's a cellist. And they're both also very restrained.
Yeah.
There's a beautiful theme. I can hear it in my head so clearly right now. Mm. That Ollie plays in After Sun.
Mm.
It's very, very beautiful, but it's only introduced periodically very, very gently through that film. And then there's obviously a burst of sound at the end with that build to Under Pressure and the conclusion of the film. And that's the same in The Stranger. It's also incredibly sparse. There's very little score for the first half of that film. There's only a couple of instances you hear it at the very, very beginning, and then a glimpse when Mark reveals himself to be an undercover operative on the recording device. And then it's more, you know, some percussion and things around Henry. But again, cello's a tactile thing. Again, it's a physical thing that you feel. It was about using the difference between the lower and higher registers. Again, the kind of contrast that you're looking for in sound, and the contrast between that, what Mark is feeling at home and the love that's behind the film. And again, you know, like I was just saying, you know, that's my son who plays Mark's son in the film. And it was really important that the film was grounded on that kind of, that level of personal investment or stakes, you know.
So how did you hook up with Oliver, and what was the collaboration like?
I'd been listening to Oliver's work for years. I do think I was introduced to Ollie potentially through Gemma Burns, who's the music supervisor on both Acute Misfortune and The Stranger. And I, you know, when we were talking in the early days about how to set this up and what to do, you know, we talked about what about the potential for Ollie, and we reached out to Ollie and got talking. And the strangest thing was that I never met Ollie until
the film was opening.
Because the film was made through COVID, I couldn't be traveling, and Ollie couldn't be traveling. So Ollie composed largely out of his garage in Glasgow. And would send files, and it was extraordinarily rigorous. Some of the main pieces, one of the main pieces certainly that's in the film, almost, I think in the same state, was from the first time I went to that underpass.
Oh, really?
And I sat there before I'd even taken the crew, and I sat there on my own, and on my iPhone I recorded the sound of the traffic passing over the bridge.
Yeah.
And I sent it to Ollie in England. And while I was still there sitting under the bridge, he sent me back this like 6 or 7 minute long piece, which is actually the concluding, the music under the search, I believe, in the film.
That's some of the most memorable music I can hear.
And I think that happened just out of that very simple thing of like, here's an extraordinarily simple idea loaded with contrast and loaded with meaning. And that collaboration was very simply between the two of us. No, you know, no big studios, no money required, nothing, you know. And Ollie composed right through the whole process. So I was able to play things to the actors. I was able to play music as we were setting scenes to sort of illustrate something of the dynamic of what we were dealing with. But then, you know, we wrote and rewrote and changed and rechanged and wrote and spotted. I mean, it was a really, it was an exhaustive process to to get that right. I'm extremely proud of the sound in both films, but particularly in The Stranger, because I feel like it had such a strong take. I knew exactly how I wanted it to feel, and I knew how I wanted it to sound, and I knew I didn't want it to sound like anything else.
Yeah.
And I just wanted it to have a very clear and concise sort of approach, something that could be spoken about and reduced down to these elemental kind of contrasts that were that are there in the material.
Mm. Yeah. You, of course, collaborated with Andy Wright to mix this, who's one of Australia's most respected mixers. What was that like?
It was so great.
Mm.
Andy was so tireless, and I really put him through the ringer.
Mm.
We worked very, very hard, and it was exhaustive. And, you know, the whole team that's involved in preparing that sound and preparing us for the mix, I'd be listening to enormous amounts of temp stuff and territories and identifying the right sounds of the vehicles and all the dialogue editing and everything else that had to be done in the lead up to the mix. So the lead to the mix was also exhaustive, and the team that I worked with there, Justine and Beth and a number of other people at Sound Firm, to really nail down the sound and the feel of the film before we even got to the mix. And then when we got into the mix, it was just about making it as dynamic as possible and taking these really very simple principles about how we wanted the film to feel and applying that in every scene, scene by scene. And, you know, I don't want to give too much of that away. It's a complex sound landscape, you know, that film, and I don't want to kind of diminish people's experience of that by talking about what that literally was. But one of the things that I will say is that, you know, the film is intensely claustrophobic, and any way that we would encourage that, any way that we could conceptually encourage the idea of claustrophobia, we would.
Yeah.
Whether that was hearing more of breath or literally vacuuming the air out of rooms when doors close. Mm. And then whenever they are outside those environments, really trying to make them feel as agoraphobic as possible, to make it feel like the environment around you and the elements around you were assailing you, whether it's the wind and sand on that beach or the air conditioning running through the hallway of a hotel. You know, that was something we were really meticulous about. And I mean, I can geek out on every aspect of filmmaking endlessly, but things like room tone are just so important. How you land room tone, because it's the kind of thing that you're not, it's like you can walk into a room with a fluorescent lamp on or a bulb that isn't tuned correctly to the, you know, to the whatever the output, and you won't know it until you turn it off.
Yeah, it's just unsettling.
And I have a visceral relationship to that sort of thing. My favorite moment of cooking is when you turn the exhaust fan off, because I don't realize how overwhelmed I am.
Oh, it's awful.
Until I flick it off, and then you feel like, oh, finally, like I can breathe. And I'm very sensitive to that sort of stuff. So I love that. I'm as obsessive about sound as I am about picture.
Yeah.
And, you know, we had a very strong take on the visuals of this film. You know, it's very dark. The palette is extremely controlled. Mm. We're really trying to direct your eye. The way the camera moves, everything is about creating this physical, insistent sense of pressure. Even when we're using a Steadicam, it's like you can use a Steadicam any number of ways. Or a piece of dolly track, any number of ways, but it had to be at the right tempo. It had to be at the tempo where you felt it physically, where you weren't ever conscious of the camera moving. It moved with the people. It was anchored to them, but we were feeling that gravity that Mark's character and Henry's character as well were feeling.
Mm.
All those elements, you're trying to get them to resonate together, right? To put you into people's shoes. And maybe that's, you know, you ask a question about subtlety and the understatement that's in the filmmaking. For me, that's required to try to get you to feel realistically what it's like to be in those shoes, because clubbing you over the head with those things is not something I'm that interested in.
Yeah.
I'm always interested. I'm so fascinated by things like how high dynamic range can work with film gestures. You know, I was just thinking about the other day the use of Kubrick's use of crash zooms in The Shining.
Yeah.
Kubrick does like 1970s TV crash zooms in The Shining. You know, Danny's throwing darts at the dartboard.
Yeah.
And he turns around and the camera crash zooms from a big wide right into his face. And then for the first time you cut around and you see the two girls standing on the other side of that sort of games room in the hotel. And that's extraordinary to me. The fact that he had some instinctive grasp of the dynamics that are possible there. I mean, I think that's something that, you know, I really like thinking about whatever the hell it is I make next. Hopefully I can, it doesn't all have to be so subtle all the time.
Yeah. Well, Tom, you've got to run off to New York. So thank you so much for making the time.
Thanks, Alfie.